For many, there's that one or two teachers who come along and leave an indelible mark, a vivid memory, an impression of how things were, or perhaps how they should be. In high school, AP World History to be exact, toward the end of the year, each class would gift our teacher, Mr. Gerrits, a poster emblematic of the characters and personalities occupying his classroom. The grade ahead of mine presented a board festooned with flying pigs as homage to Mr. Gerrits' predictions of Jesse Ventura, pro wrestler cum actor cum suburban mayor, becoming governor of Minnesota. For the class before them, it was a portrait of a stoic Dick Nixon, a common Gerrits bete noir, emblazoned with the words love, American style. For my class, we went with something a bit more highbrow, Raphael's School of Athens. You know the picture. A large congregation of mostly toga-clad men vacillating between cherubic locks and male-patterned baldness, all while under arched marble, pontificating to their little heart's content. In real life, the School of Athens was commissioned by Pope Julius II, constructed between the years 1509 and 1511, and to this day sits within the walls of the Vatican City's Apostolic Palace. Raphael's masterpiece has, quote, come to symbolize the marriage between art, philosophy, and science, unquote, i.e., the very essence of scholarship. As for our rendering, at the center was Plato, adorned by a small cutout of Mr. Gerrits' head, pearly beard and all. Around him were other august luminaries from antiquity to the Renaissance, each with their own little cutout of some googly-eyed high schooler from the waning days of the second millennium AD. For me, I got Plum Real Estate right down in front as Hercules, an ancient Greek philosopher who's just happily doodling away on his piece of parchment. Raphael would use this particular Gratian as a stand-in for his contemporary and fellow master, Michelangelo. You see, the academy is old, real old. From the groves of Academe to the stone halls of Oxbridge onto pastoral New England colleges educating America's earliest ministers, theologians, and men of arts and letters, the institution known as higher education has had centuries, nay, millennia, to build walls, construct tradition, and cement long-held customs. Outside of organized government, few systems are as labyrinthian, hierarchical, and bureaucratic as a large university. Inside, like ogres and onions, there are layers, fiefdoms, closely guarded turf. For the academy, change and innovation often compete against the weight of history, an anvil comprised of Jungian collectives, familiar rites of passage, aspirations, dreams, and defeats. But what if, like shaking an etch-a-sketch, all of that baggage dissolved into a crisp, clean canvas?
From the University of Minnesota Rochester, I'm Amber Klein, and this is Beyond the Nest. Today, we look at Dr. Stephen Lemkuhl, UMR's inaugural chancellor. Serving from 2007 until his retirement in 2017, Dr. Lemkuhl had one of academia's rarest of opportunities, starting a public four-year university from scratch. Our story is told in three acts. Act 1, Visions, or Tales from the Research Bench. Act 2, Ghosts of University Past, Confronting the Specter of History, Tradition, and the Way Things Have Always Been. Act 3, Tabula Rasa, When Presented with a Blank Slate, Where to Begin, and How to Define Purpose. Stay with us, won't you?
Act 1, Visions. In neuroscience, the visual pathway is the route by which light flows from the eyes to the brain, resulting in image and sight, thus facilitating skills such as reading. The process begins when visual sensations strike the eye. Once through to the lens, the retina transforms light energy into electrical signals. From there, at the optic chasm, data captured in one eye crosses with data captured in another. Now along the optic track, this combined visual information is sent to the lateral geniculate bodies before making its way via optic radiations to the visual cortex. While all of that takes a mere 13 milliseconds, disruptions along the way can have profound and lasting effects. In 1993, Dr. Stephen Lehmkuhl, along with colleagues from the University of Missouri St. Louis's School of Optometry, published an article in the New England Journal of Medicine.
I had an opportunity to go back to the Midwest, and that's where we kind of grew up. And I was in a school of optometry, and it's actually there where I began to have develop a more health focus, because now all of a sudden I was in the clinic measuring evoked brain potentials of infants and doing color vision of kids and so on, things that, you know, I would lecture about, talk about. And the fact that's where one of my articles that I was most proud of is in the New England Journal of Medicine, that was about the visual problems, visual processing issues with children with dyslexia. And it was the first article ever published by an optometry faculty member in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Prior to these findings, it was thought that deficiencies in visual pathways were not responsible for reading challenges in children. Dr. Lehmkuhl and his colleagues would prove these long-held assumptions outdated. For Dr. Lehmkuhl, this work was an interesting turn to his career. Prior to arriving at the vast and expansive University of Missouri system, Dr. Lehmkuhl had studied and worked in a variety of environments, each dedicated to the pursuit of academic scholarship.
I started out at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, for my first year, ran out of money, went to back home where I could get a job and go to school at Wright State University, and I got my undergraduate degree there. I was a psychology major, and I wanted to go to graduate school, and I was fortunate to get a fellowship at Vanderbilt University, and that's where I got my PhD. After that, I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Virginia, and my background, back then it was called physiological psychology, but today you would call it neuroscience, and my field of specialization was vision.
In pursuing a doctorate, Dr. Lehmkuhl, like many a berobed scholar before him, had a choice to make as graduation approached: academe or industry.
During my travels, my journey, it was about research. And during my time period, which this is back in the 70s, there was a lot of doors open for research faculty members. Now, I have to tell you that those doors closed because I do remember applying for 100 jobs at the end of my postdoc. I got 99 rejection letters, and I had one letter of acceptance or one job offer. That was from Brown University, and that's where I was there for 6 years. But, you know, back then, I don't think I had all my eggs in that academic basket.
Dr. Lehmkuhl would spend 6 years in Providence, Rhode Island, before being lured to the University of Missouri St. Louis's School of Optometry. In this change, Dr. Lehmkuhl would move from the lectern and the research bench to the clinic, where he would have the opportunity to sink his hands further into the health sciences. It was also at the University of Missouri where Dr. Lehmkuhl would get a front row seat to the minutiae of higher education administration.
I served as a chair of the Faculty Senate for 2 years at University of Missouri St. Louis. At the end of that term, the Vice President for Academic Affairs for the University of Missouri System invited me to do a faculty fellowship, which in essence was a way of, it was like an administrative internship. And I went up there, and I was supposed to be up there like 2-3 days a week. So this was in Columbia, Missouri. So I was commuting from St. Louis to Columbia. And 6 months into the job, the vice president for academic affairs is named the chancellor of the Columbia campus. And so I remember the current president of the University of Missouri coming into my office and says, I don't know what the heck to call you, but this keeps showing up for work. And that's what I did. And then I became an acting vice president, which I've always thought was a funny term because I go around telling everybody I'm trying to act like a vice president. then I did become the vice president. And I was in that role for about, well, it's for 11 years. At the end of that, there was about a year period where I served as an interim chancellor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. So I'm on the other side of the state. And it's there where I really felt that I really liked that administrative role because I was having more, I could have a more direct impact. And I felt I was flying a little too high. Mm-hmm. And so it was after that experience, that 8 month, 9 month interim chancellor experience, that I started to apply for jobs. And that's when the Rochester job happened.
Over those 11 years hovering around the top of the academic pyramid, Dr. Lemkul would learn a great deal. He would also encounter lairs, fiefdoms, and closely guarded turf. Act 2, Ghosts of University Past. At the University of Missouri, as Dr. Lemkul found himself in roles of ever-increasing responsibility, he took note of those who he encountered, fellow administrators and system leaders, not only his contemporaries, but folks who had come before him as well. He observed their approach to work, how they navigated challenges and disruptions, paying particular attention to the manner in which they led. Looking back, Dr. Lemkul writes in his 2020 book, Campus with Purpose,
I found myself sorting leaders into two broad categories. The first group I referred to as custodial leaders, who wanted to maintain status quo. They focused their efforts on operating cleanly and efficiently. They believed that the current challenges were transitory. The custodial leaders tended to tactically tinker around institutional margins while waiting for more favorable and better fiscal times to return. My second category was change leaders, who believed that institutional transformation was necessary to adapt to the changing future. They focused their efforts on change management. I also observed that the life of a change leader was more difficult.
After more than a decade in various leadership roles at the University of Missouri, including System Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs, Dr. Lemkul took a flyer on a quirky little school up north. From what he knew, this newly minted campus of the University of Minnesota was looking for its inaugural chancellor. Following successful and decades-long push to fully incorporate the U of M in the community of Rochester, the next step was building a campus from scratch. This highly unique set of circumstances presented Dr. Lemkul, then looking for an opportunity to enact meaningful change within higher education, a testing ground for a new and innovative approach. In Campus with Purpose, Dr. Lemkul writes of his colleagues' reaction to the possibility of him becoming chancellor.
They believed that launching a new campus enabled a leader to create change without all the emotional and operational transaction costs associated with undoing things and starting new things that they experienced at their established institutions.
In accepting the role with UMR, Dr. Lemkul would not only have a chance to demonstrate his brand of leadership, but confront various specters and apparitions lurking across the hallowed halls of academe. Remnants left over from decades, centuries, and millennia dedicated to the pursuit of knowledge and scholarship. Traditions built up over time, long-established customs, schools of thought, and of course, departmental policy. Dr. Lemkul writes,
managing change, even for a nascent campus, is a battle with the ghost of university past. I did not want to instinctively deploy existing organizational structures or common practices, but be open to examine the best ways to execute the campus purpose. The best approach may or may not be the prevailing habit, common practice, or an existing structure of higher education. My fear was that if I wasn't diligent, the ghost of university past would push the campus toward being a franchise and divert it from its purpose.
For Dr. Lemkuhl, becoming the inaugural chancellor of the University of Minnesota Rochester would cap a long and dedicated career in academia and afford him the opportunity to explore new paradigms while pushing back old phantasms.
I fully appreciate it. I no longer had to manage change because I was always doing that. And I would always be doing that if I went to establish an institution. Here, I thought at UMR I could create change. I would have more of a blank slate. And at the end of the day, that's what really attracted me to come to the University of Minnesota Rochester.
And today's final act, tabula rasa. Straddling philosophy and epistemology, tabula rasa, or the concept of a blank slate, dates back to Aristotle, who wrote of the mind as an unscribed tablet. Piggybacking on the old tradition, the Stoics viewed the soul as a sheet of paper awaiting the pen. And a few years after that, Englishman John Locke would add to the discourse with the idea that, at birth, the mind is an empty sheet, eager for experience. For Dr. Lemkuhl, his experience, mixed with a quirky opportunity, met the perfect canvas.
They wanted it to be distinctive, something special. The second one was is they wanted it to be world-class. Now, gosh, you know, I used to ask, what do they mean by world-class? Well, you know, they had, and the community has, Mayo Clinic and IBM. These are world-class institutions. I know that's an aspiration goal, but the point is that they wanted something that campus to be distinctive and recognized widely and favorably for what it does. And then the third one is that you need to add value. You need to add value to the community. You need to add value to the city. You need to add value to the itself. And there were other higher ed providers in Rochester. And how do we both be distinctive and how to add value? So being distinctive, world class, and how to add value. When you answer the question, how do you add value to whom? I said it was had a University of Minnesota was making a commitment. And what did University of Minnesota need? Well, they have a lot. I mean, as a large comprehensive campus, but what we could add was real value in student learning research and commit as a campus to do student learning research. And then the second was, of course, the city of Rochester needed a healthcare workforce. So we decided to be real focused and distinctive in that. And the distinctiveness is that we were an undergraduate health campus and we built everything around that.
The cornerstone to UMR's distinct foundation is its approach to academics. And from the get-go, now Chancellor Lemkuhl envisioned something much different than what he had encountered along his journey with the creation of the Center for Learning Innovation.
I just didn't think you could serve students well by proliferating degree programs, because as soon as you create one, by the time they get finished with it, there's another degree that's really more relevant. And then what I saw, and I was a big believer in creating networks around a value proposition. And I didn't want there to be competition and for resources. And I wanted debate, but I wanted around the right conversation. So if we could not have departments per se, like an English department or a science and biology department and so on, but if we could have one unit that was truly interdisciplinary, who could bring these diverse viewpoints around that one value proposition, how do we best promote student learning development and prepare them for life and health-related careers, then let's build a structure that supports that. And so that's what started the Center for Learning Innovation. And I know it was hard on the faculty. I mean, a biologist and a philosopher is trained to think differently. They have different cultural backgrounds, mores, and they're going to interact differently. And I'm so proud of, at least the time I was there, the UMR faculty, how they navigated through all that. And the richness of that kind of teamwork, that diverse kind of debate, I really created the rich model, that the learning model that we have at UMR.
With the Center for Learning Innovation, or CLI, as the focal point of a UMR student's academic experience, the next stroke of the brush was creating a guide who could shepherd their growth, scholastic discovery, and professional aspirations.
This is something where UMR was very intentional. We talked earlier about the three R's, you know, and I've always said the most critical R, rigor, relevance, and the third R is the most critical for relationships. But you have to be very intentional about that. I had a lot of pushback in the early days in terms of putting together the student success coach model, because what other institutions do is they really have what I call academic advisors whose goal really is to help students sort courses and pick the course for next year. Mm-hmm. The kind of stuff that I think is so critical, and I used to call it becoming of our students, is to form those relationships, and I call the becoming relationship between the student success coach and that student, so they can grow. So that conversation that they have their first year is going to be different than the conversation that they have their fourth year. But it's important that that relationship is established over all those 4 years. And the student success coaches have to have the time to have those interactions with students. You can't do this if you have 300 students to one student success coach. So we were intentional about that. We had a lot of pushback, I remember. We were inefficient, I remember them saying. And I just said, no, this is an investment in student success, and I just think that's an important investment.
Pushback notwithstanding, alongside this new approach to student advisement was a novel twist on the long-dreaded faculty office hours.
The Just Ask was around this principle of relationships and how do we create these relationships between faculty and students, remove the barriers. And as I write about in the book, and I've noticed this in other places too, that, you know, students think that if you have to go to a Just Ask, they thought of it as a tutoring center, and you don't go there unless you're struggling. And you didn't want to tell everybody you're struggling. You know, only smart students don't go there, and I'm a smart student. Well, we tried to break through all of that by just creating a space that was just easy. You know, it was just a place to hang out. And, you know, faculty and students are just hanging out together, talking about stuff that's going on in the class.
And tying it all together like a well-worn rug was a senior year project aimed at not just measuring a student's acquired skills and knowledge, but how they evolved over the course of their time at UMR and reflections on what they learned about themselves along the way.
My strong belief is that learning is about knowing and becoming, and we've got to do both. All right, and we got to support it throughout the curriculum in terms of knowledge base and understanding about health sciences and biology and the chemistry and the physics and math and all that. But it's also about becoming. And becoming is where some of those foundational skills is. It's where we talk about intercultural competency. It's where we talk about tolerance of ambiguity. We talk about, you know, those things are going to be as important as any of their knowledge things. So we've got to support both. So we wanted a structure in the capstone that would help promote the development of all. So for instance, having the students have to even write a proposal and put their own learning experience together for the capstone and have it reviewed and criticized, and then they have to re-edit it. They're having to take ownership of their own learning. That's one of the most important foundational skills that will support them as they go forward, right? The other reason that we put the capstone together is because I didn't, the world is changing so rapidly, and I use the expression in the book, exponential times, that there's no way we can predict. It's just difficult to predict that this is specific knowledge that you need today, because tomorrow it's going to be different. So you have to have that flexibility, adaptability in the curriculum. And so the students then could customize their own learning experience.
Over a 10-year period of time, Chancellor Lemkuhl would initiate many of what are referred to as high-impact practices aimed at delivering a more equitable and holistic approach to higher education. These innovative endeavors would lay the groundwork for UMR's continued growth and expansion. However, in 2017, Chancellor Lemkuhl announced his retirement.
Well, I felt good about leaving the campus because it was, and I've stated this in other venues, it was critical that we had the right leadership, the right leadership transition. And Chancellor Carroll has done that, and I was a big, big supporter of her getting that leadership role, and I did everything I possibly could to see that happen. So I feel, and I know Chancellor Carroll well, and she has embodied this purpose as well as anyone. So I feel really good about that.
In retirement, Chancellor Emeritus Lemkuhl has written about his experiences leading the University of Minnesota Rochester in his book, Campus with Purpose, hits the links and spends quality time with friends and family.
I visited this past summer and it just felt like home. And so I do miss the faculty, the staff, the students, but the golf course is kind of nice too. So and obviously it's just great for Cindy and I to spend a lot of time together and chase grandkids and so on. And it was that time in my life to do that.
And in between swings and putts, Chancellor Emeritus Lemkuhl has had quite a bit of time to do some reflecting of his own, and here's what he has to say.
I tell others, if I knew then what I know now, I would have sounded really smart back then. So it was a learning experience for all of us. What I have learned, and I mentioned this earlier, is that, ideas are easy. I mean, I sort of knew how to do this stuff, or not how to do it, but what should be done, or, you know, what we should be doing this, and we should be focusing on the student here, or whatever. But to implement those ideas was really hard. And I put the faculty and staff in some really tough situations, you know. Here it is, go do it. And then they all look at me, well, how do we do it? You know, but they're the ones that had to figure out. So, you know, UMR is where it is today because of the faculty and because of the students.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Nest, UMR's alumni podcast. Join us next month as we pry open the books and take a peek at what makes UMR such a unique and innovative academic experience. Beyond the Nest is produced by UMR Alumni Relations, written and narrated by Marco Lanz, and edited by Dante Fumo. Until next time, I'm Amber Klein.